welcome back to another edition of the Sunstone Podcast. I'm your host, John Larson. We're here in the studio down in Salt Lake City, and I'm really excited because I'm here with a celebrity. So whenever there's a celebrity, and she's not from here, Gina, say hello.
Kia ora, everybody, and it's lovely to be here in the Sunstone offices, and I just want to say it's very tidy here.
We are planning on having a great big open house in June, and Lindsay and crew have done a great job of sort of revamping this office. We've joked about it before on the podcast. There's, you know, 40 years of junk in here, and we're moving things around. But you can see with the studio, people who've been listening will notice there's a little bit of echo, and right over there is a big pile of baffles. We're going big time, so
this looks very serious.
Yes. We're in a back bedroom of a house built in like 1908, but it's a lot of fun. So welcome to Salt Lake City, my hometown.
Thank you. It's always lovely to be here.
Now, you are from New Zealand.
Indeed.
And let's give your bona fides. So tell me all the things that you do. Your podcast and your writing and all that stuff.
Oh, I am the host of a Thoughtful Faith podcast. I'm an independent scholar. I'm an adjunct fellow at the University of Canterbury. My area of writing currently is actually in missiology, which is the study of mission.
The study of mission?
Yes, it's a thing.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah. I've got a chapter coming out in the Oxford Handbook of Mission Studies, and it has nothing to do with Mormonism, which is a real relief, John, I have to say, not to have to put Mormon in anything. And so I do other independent writing on racism and colonialism. In the Mormon world, I have a blog called Kiwi Mormon, and I've published in lots of journals, Mormon journals and things.
So we were talking before we started, it's been jarring for you down there. There's been, you of course had the shooting a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
We in the States have been very impressed with how you guys handle things.
It takes good leadership, John. But we have a population of 4.5 million. And I think right from the outset, we had to, as a nation, deal with the fact that we were dealing with Māori and also colonial settlers, British settlers.
Right.
So there's, and by the time the British government got to New Zealand, they really had not enough money to have a standing army in New Zealand. So they had to go the way of peace. I mean, we don't understand ourselves. We're not like a gun-toting country. I think, you know, in rural districts, you know, guns and things are used on farms, but even police don't carry weapons.
Right.
They have them in their trunk, or their boot, as I would say, in local parlance. They have them in their trunk, and they have to, like, sign them out if they're going to use them. So I'm not, you know, we're just not even used to the presence of guns in cities. So this was an extraordinary event that just came out of, well, I wanted to say it came out of nowhere, but it didn't come out of nowhere. It took us completely by surprise. But what's been really beautiful about the whole experience is the way in which the leadership of our country, and that's Jacinda Ardern, the world's most famous former Mormon. I think she left in about 2005, so she would have been in her late 20s when she left. Her family, her LDS family, is a very prominent Mormon family. Her father is Ross Ardern, and her uncle, who is the identical twin of her father, was the principal of Church College New Zealand and also a recent general authority. And I think he's on the regional, on the area presidency. So, you know, it's a family that's well known in Mormon leadership throughout the country.
Well, I was touched by the response, and I followed your postings to see, and there was clearly, you know, pain there. And it forces communities to grow up and reckon with their own beliefs. I know for me, over the last few years, I've had to reconcile. Islam is a religion that I've been very dismissive of. And I recognize that that's a soft form of discrimination, even though, you know, I would say it's doctrinal, it's not cultural. But our minds aren't as bifurcated and compartmentalized as we think. And it's been really tough for me to deal with things, you know, like the head scarves and head coverings that I saw as a form of oppression of women, to recognize, well, yeah, but if we go rip all those off of those women, that's an even worse oppression of women. And it's a difficult issue to deal with.
It is indeed. And, you know, there last Friday I was in Hagley Park at they had the Friday prayer service.
Mm-hmm.
None of the Muslim community could go into their mosques. Obviously, it's, you know, they're in, well, they were at that point being refurbished and cleaned up.
Right.
And so 20,000 New Zealanders came out, or people from our city came out and celebrated Friday prayers with the Muslim community. And all of us non-Muslim women just sat with our hijabs on, and we all sat quietly as they went to prayer. It was a really, really sacred experience. It was quite extraordinary, actually. And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't have any words for this. Who would have thought, you know, a couple of weeks ago, that this would even be possible? So I think one of the things that is really characteristic of the response is the extraordinary emphasis on compassion and understanding and love and being with people where they are. And I think that has made me tremendously proud of my country, but tremendously proud of my city. A lot of tears, and I'm late to this interview because I was just watching the live stream of the National Memorial Service, and I've just spent the last 2 hours crying, wishing I was at home with my people. It's been a hard, hard experience, but also a really beautiful experience. And you realize just, it kind of shifts all the paradigms, as we were saying before. You think, okay, the only thing that really makes sense to pour into this moment of tremendous darkness is just compassion and light. And I don't say that frivolously. There's sort of a tangible sort of dissidence to choosing to love where you could hate. And there was a man who had been his wife had been killed in one of the mosque shootings, and he spoke at this memorial service, and he said, in his broken English, he said, well, I could be like a volcano. I could be seething inside and boiling inside, and if I explode, it goes everywhere. Or I can settle myself and bring peace into my heart and understand that everyone, even the shooter, is my brother. And for someone to say that at 2 weeks out from losing his wife, it was just the depth and the thought that had gone into the way that he wanted to see this, he wanted to move forward, was just really inspiring.
Yeah, and moving forward is, of course, the theme here.
Yes.
We were talking before about me in particular, and I'm sure you get a lot of this. We can dig into that. But I get a lot of people sending me messages or posting on social media that they're very confused by me.
Yes. Yes, you are confusing, John Larson. I mean, I've been confused, and you and I sort of missed each other. You had the Mormon Expression, and then I came on to A Thoughtful Faith about the same time as you're wrapping up with Mormon Expression.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find ourselves in the same room with a conversation,
right,
about what keeps us swirling around in this community. So I'm really interested to hear from you about why
I'm here.
Why you are here.
Why am I back? Well, I think, like everything, it's complicated. For people leaving the church, there's really three types of people who leave the church. I always have to oversimplify everything in a slightly offensive way. The majority of people in Utah are actually basically ex-Mormons. But just like the rest of the world, religion is a facet of their life that doesn't control their life. It's a part of what they do, and for some of them it's a deep identity, but it's not an identity that they really filter every decision through, especially for old religions. You know, you'll find people who are, you know, Catholic or Hindu or whatever, and it's part of their identity. And no one would ever say, you just did X, Y, or Z, you're not a Hindu. I mean, I guess there's some like fringers who would, but that's not a prevalent thing, right? But so we have the people who just slide out, and that's most of everybody in Utah. If you're talking to somebody, odds are you're talking to an ex-Mormon who doesn't identify as an ex-Mormon. And then you have the people for whom leaving the church, crashing out of the church, was very traumatic. Some of them suffer PTSD, some of them a lot of trauma, and it just depends on what happens. So you have the people who it's traumatic, and then you have people who took Mormonism very seriously. Like they studied it, they learned about it, they tried to live it, they believed it, they took it seriously. And for those people, when they lose their faith, they need a lot of processing. So they're not necessarily kind of traumatized. So this community really centers around those second two groups, the traumatized people and the people who find this thing that happened to them very intellectually appealing.
It's funny.
So for me, you know, my journey has been, I was more of the latter. Like, I didn't experience a lot of trauma in the church, and there's plenty of people who do. There's plenty of people who are abused, who have very miserable, you know, existences in the church. That wasn't my experience. But as I needed to process it, I needed to talk to people about it. So that's how I kind of first got into the community. It was 15 years ago. But then I started to see a lot of this pain and trauma. And of course, as I left the church, my family relationships were strained also. So I experienced it to some degree or the other, but not like a lot of people. I don't want to co-opt the people who've had a lot of trauma leaving the church. Hmm. Well, when you're in this space, it's impossible to escape from this pain. It's impossible to escape from the trauma. And, you know, I've gotten to several process points where I just had to take a step back. I ran Mormon Expression for 5 years. It was a good run. I'm intellectually mostly on the same page. I mean, I recorded a podcast near the end, said things that I disagree with myself about. So I see myself as being able to change my opinion over time, which I see is a good thing. But the last few years, you know, we're talking about the shootings and the governmental corruption and infighting, and I'm not coming at it from one side or the other. I look at the infighting that's happening between the two parties in the United States, the same things that are going on with Brexit. There's this sort of stuff going on in Australia, you know, this retreat to the right, and it's been devastating to me to watch the things that I believe in, for some of them to realize they're not as true as I thought they were. To see the, you know, the privilege and the opportunities that I've been given that I just took advantage of. And I became really dejected, especially about 6 months ago. I probably bottomed out, just feeling like, you know, I can't, just reading the news all the time and just watching this world that I wanted to see built kind of slipping away. And then Lindsay called me. So I'm back here, and people think that my message now is different than my message before. I think the church has been adequately deconstructed. If you want to believe the church because it's factually true or historically true, my personal belief is that's impossible, because it's full of contradictions. Like, it's A and not A at the same time, and you have to suspend logic. But I feel like I did a decent job of deconstructing the church in the past, and I don't get any pleasure out of doing that. So to me now, it's all about the people and this rift in our community, this polarization, this fight that we have. And I go to the same stores with Mormons. I'm around them all the time. I have great friends who are believers, and it doesn't impact us. So I want to try to figure out a way to have just a little bit less pain with the leaving process, and I have no idea how to do that.
I love it. But it is, I mean, it's really, it's such a complex issue, particularly where, you know, I come here and there's sort of this roiling kind of motion and tension where everybody is constantly in conversation with one Mormon part of themselves. And I think the temperature of the agitation is actually inflated by your political situation.
Yes. They're mirrors.
Yes. Yeah. And this is what I was saying to a friend yesterday. I said, I feel like the LDS church in some way is an expression of whatever the general mood of the United States political and economic scene is.
Well, yes, I think that's exactly right. And in Mormon theology, especially post-polygamy and then post-World War II, the church really took on an identity of uber-Americans. Mm. It's literally baked into the religion, you know, American nationalism and white nationalism. We try to and I think generally speaking, Mormons try to be more progressive on race issues, but we don't like to talk about the fact that it's literally canonized in two entirely different books of scripture, the Pearl Great Price and the Book of Mormon, racism. Like 2 Nephi chapter 21, verse 5, is that it? That people are made brown so that white people won't be attracted to them. It literally says that in the scriptures. I mean, that's pretty hard stuff to stomach. So, but more than that, it was Reader's Digest. It was America. It was what's that big festival they have every 4th of July down in Provo? It is just this biggest flag waving. And we unfortunately, we married American nationalism and Mormonism in ways we don't know how to extract them away from each other.
Now. Exactly. And it's interesting that you say that, because one of the things that we notice, and we always, you know, living outside of the United States, I mean, it's about as far away as you can get. And it's very much a brown person's religion, faith in New Zealand.
So the Maori are more likely to be Mormons than, is that what you're saying?
Yes, in terms of demographics, you'll find probably Maori were always the largest population, ethnic population in the LDS Church. Mm-hmm. And I think we've been surpassed by Pacifica people, Polynesian, mm-hmm. Samoan and Tongan. So it's always been a brown person's religion. So we've always sort of seen this American iteration and being really standoffish about it. Like, oh, you know, the polygamy, well, that's an American thing. The black thing, that's an American thing. And have sort of done our own thing in that regard. But I think I'm thinking back to 9/11, where the ideological rift between New Zealand, which is a democratic socialist nation, and I think Europe, our sensibilities are more European than American. So when 9/11 happened, we were reading it through that hermeneutic of a democratic socialist state, mm-hmm. not a militarized state. And Gordon Hinckley gets up at General Conference, and I've said this before, and I'm watching it, I'm living in Taiwan at the time, and he says, he announces that American forces have just gone into Afghanistan. And we were highly suspicious.
This is 2003. I remember that speech because I sat in a parking lot to listen to it.
Yes.
I was in Wendover gambling at the time, but I went out and I sat in a parking lot to listen to that speech because we were all wondering, what is Gordon B. Hinckley going to say?
Yeah. Yeah. And what did you think?
I was very disappointed.
Yeah. Why were you disappointed?
Because he basically said, we trust our leaders.
Yeah.
And it didn't take long before we found out the yellow cake and the Bush administration was lying flat out. Mm-hmm. And the church... The church never responded, never backtracked his words. And he basically said, we have to just go with what the government says. And now, with the hindsight of 15, 20 years, we know it was mostly lies.
Yeah, it was. And we kind of had suspected that because, you know, we're not brewed in this American hubris. So we suspected that there was something more to this whole thing than we had, you know, that was being popularly said. And when he said we need to support the president, we thought, oh, well. What president?
Yeah.
You want us to support your American president? Like, how are we going to support your American president? And we could feel the, particularly across Europe and Britain and, you know, France and Belgium, people going, what on earth? And I think he tried to address it in the following conference.
Right.
Because, and he said, you know, I think he said, we find ourselves on two sides of a great debate. And for most of us, we're going, it's not two sides of a great debate. It's just one debate. There's one side. Either you're going to take the Christian way or you're going to start thatching in your American ideology into this church and take this kind of very narrow, structured, sort of militaristic, corporate, obedient role. And, you know, and what I wanted to say to Gordon Hinckley and everybody else at that time is like, Sonny Jim, you need to understand that you are talking to an international body in this church. And you don't get to assume that we are politically in agreement with the United States. And you know, the thing that's been so disappointing is the consciousness. You could have actually sparked alive a new sense of consciousness that the LDS Church, and they made a great deal of the fact that it was now an international church. There are more people on the outside of the United States than on the in the United States. They could have made a lot of that tension that was created by that one statement. But I felt like they retrenched because there was so much disappointment. I mean, I speak to, you know, people outside And there was just such terrible, terrible disappointment that he couldn't rise above his own Americanness.
Well, and there's been a long history of these things. I mean, I think just in the podcast with Harvard, we were going through the David O. McKay journals. Same sort of thing. If people who know history know that Ezra Taft Benson was kind of pulled from the pulpit and sent to Europe to repent because his rhetoric was so stridently, right-wing American. And there's been that undercurrent the whole time. And I look and say, I know that the first missionaries went to like Mexico City in like 1852. It was like really early in the church. And so there's been a continual presence of like South American Mormons since the beginning, but they're not represented in church governance. They're not represented in the manuals. They're not represented in the stories. And the church's response, rather than having a manual that takes lessons from all around the world, is, well, let's dumb it down. Let's remove all the cultural elements to it and just make it like into mush. I mean, that's pretty harsh, but...
But it is mush because it's not theologically robust.
It's not even theologically... It's not even theological.
No, it's not theological. It's just a set of propositions, right? Policies and propositions with the underlying assumption that you're going to obey the prophet. And, you know, I mean, let me just not put too fine a point on it. That point, when Gordon Hinckley gave that, it was almost permission to live into the suspicion that I had that a president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints could not be relied upon to speak to at my interests, A, as a woman, as Māori, and as a New Zealander. So it kind of set me free in that respect. I thought, okay.
Well, so would you say before that your testimony was pretty solid?
I think solid. I mean, on paper, for sure. I mean, I've had every auxiliary presidency job. And the stake in the ward. No, I haven't been Stake Relief Society president. But so there's always been a question. There has to be a question. If you aren't sparked alive by some kind of question, then I don't think you're really engaging with your faith tradition.
Well, I agree. My faith crisis started brewing in about 2002. Well, I had one on my mission, but 2002, 2003. And even before that, I think from the mid-90s, I gave up saying, I know the church is true. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't, even though I was a believer, but I just couldn't make that assertion. It didn't fit with me epistemologically. Mm-hmm. I didn't know the church was true. I felt that it was true. I felt like I had a testimony. And hell, growing up as a Mormon boy in Zion, there were things that were just baked in that I didn't even question. So in that sense, you could say I knew those things were true. Some of them turned out to be wrong. Some of them turned out to be right. But I think that's what that third category I started talking about, these sort of people who intellectualize. I was fascinated by Mormonism. I was fascinated by religion. And then if you just do that, if you read the New Testament, like sincerely, you're going to sit in a Mormon sacrament meeting and say, a lot of this is not scriptorial. As a matter of fact, you're very not in alignment with the Gospels.
Yes.
And I think there's a lot of believers who have done a sincere study who see that. They see this incongruitness that some of us, it just gets too much and we eventually say, I can't do this anymore.
And I think, I mean, I'm interested to know what you think about this. Because, I mean, I'm very much a person who feels a call into a spiritual life. And that has multiple trajectories. You know, as Māori, a lot of our cultural expressions are done through attention to the spiritual. And then when I say spiritual, I think there is a sort of a sense of a unitive something that sits beneath all of life experience, something that's deeper, that calls us into more. So as Māori, I have to engage with that because that's just part of who I am. As Mormon, it's asked me to engage in an institutional, formative way with that conversation. But what I have found, and I think similar to you, I poured all of my angst about the church into interest in history and trying to find the thing to think that would make everything right.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. That searching for the key to make it work.
Yes.
And you have to search deeper and deeper and deeper. And they're saying, you know, don't delve too deep. And you're like, you don't understand. I'm trying to make it work. Yes. I'm trying to resolve all this tension. Yeah. And there's a lot of it. But a lot of people don't experience that, and that's okay.
Hmm, that is. I mean, you know, we're kind of thinky people.
Yeah. I was reading in the New York Times this morning. I shared it with my wife. There's a woman, they isolated this gene. There's a woman who's never felt pain or anxiety.
Wow.
And they found that the genetic mutation that causes that. And, you know, both of us were like, sign me up, man, you know. So I think there's people who sort of genetically or whatever have that with Mormonism, whatever faith they're in. They can engage the good parts, they can listen to the positive, and they can just sort of ignore the painful parts. And I admire that to a degree, except they become part of an imperialistic sort of system.
Yes.
that imposes negativity on underprivileged populations, and they don't see it. And of course, we are all part of that. There's layers and layers and layers of privilege, and there's layers and layers of opportunity that we had, you know, that, you know, and I say we colloquial because you start getting intersectionality and it gets really into a cluster really fast. But that's you can still hear the tension in me. I can't just release it and say, hey, if you want to be a Mormon, good for you. I say, if you want to be a Mormon, don't hurt other people, then good for you.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because I just finished listening to Jacinda Ardern talk about the moral imperative that we have to reject willful ignorance.
Mm.
Because it's all on a spectrum. Whatever, whether or not your racism is benevolent, or your sexism, or your homophobia is a sort of a benevolent ism, the end result, you know, that it still exists on the same spectrum as extremism, and both survive, one for their head in the sand and one for their fundamentalist extremism and kind of violent violence, rely upon elective ignorance about the totality of this, of what they're talking about. And I think that's one of the things that irritates me most about the LDS experience. And I don't find any kindness in benevolent ignorance or willful ignorance. There is no kindness in saying, leave me alone to enjoy whatever I have in this tradition, even if the reproduction of it is deleterious to women or deleterious to LGBT people. I just don't think that that's a worthy enough excuse. Like, if you're going to sign up for a tradition, understand it. If you're going to sign up for a culture, understand it. Be literate.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these Firesides, featuring a weekly evening podcast. It will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
Another article in the New York Times, I think from Sunday, this would have been like March 22nd, if you want to look it up. There's an article in there about procrastination. And it pointed out, because I always feel like I'm a big procrastinator, and I always feel guilty about it, but I'm really busy all the time. Like, I'm a dude who has to keep himself busy. So, but the article basically said, to sum it up, is we procrastinate because we don't want to deal with the emotions surrounding whatever task it is we're putting off. And I read that and I'm like, exactly. You know, like, you put off your taxes because you know on a subconscious level, what you're going to deal with emotionally when you do your taxes. And even though you know in the back of your head, you'll feel better when it's done, you don't have to deal with it. You guys probably don't have to do taxes like we do
here. Yeah, we do.
Just some countries is a lot easier than here.
It is. Let me just clarify. It is. We do taxes, but not like you guys do taxes.
Right. So when I start looking at the things I procrastinate, I did a little inventory after I read that article. Yep. It's all about that. I don't want to deal with that emotional space. The reason I bring this up is I think that same thing happens with things that we run into. You know, maybe a feminist writer points out an area of privilege that we never considered before. Maybe we recognize that a product that we enjoy, like our shoes, are being done by slave labor, and we don't want to confront that. We don't want to deal with the emotion of accepting guilt. And this goes back to that first question that you asked me. I think part of my maturing is recognizing I can't get rid of the guilt or the complicity that I had in being part of Mormonism by rejecting it. That if it feels like you can, but I can't. I'm part of it, and I have to acknowledge that in a micro portion, I was involved in the imperialism. You know, I went on a mission. I tried to get people to abandon their culture. I cut people off from the support networks that they would have had. I was a kid. I was doing it because I was told to do it, but I did it. And there's a reason why wars are always fought by 19-year-old kids, because we know that we can control those kids, right? Because if you try to send a bunch of 40-year-olds off, they'll send them that. Now, wait a minute. You want me to take that hill? What? To explain to me again why we need that hill? You know, so this sounds really terrible, but I feel like at this stage of my life, you have to embrace your own lousiness and realize it's part of the human experience. Then you can address it as an adult. So my big shift that puts me here today and the kind of the things that I'm preaching is not because people think I want to build institutional bridges to the church. I don't. I want you to build a better relationship with your mother. Mm-hmm. I want your neighbor to build a better relationship with you, because I've become kind of an anarchist when it comes to institutions. They're all disappointing to me. And the bigger they are, the more disappointing they are. So what we have to do is we have to do things on a micro scale. That means I need to repair the relationships with Mormons that I have, that people I come in contact with, and not worry so much about the church. I think that's morally where I'm at. That's not the whole driver of this podcast, but that's where I sit.
So let me just get this straight. So you have, what was your leaving like? Like, where were you at your leaving?
My leaving was, the easiest way to leave is to move. Mm-hmm. And we just happened that I was the Sunday school teacher, the adult Sunday school teacher. I was a popular one. Because at the time, I had lost my faith in God. But I wasn't really, I was turd polishing.
Right.
I really wanted to bring out the best. So I would read the book. I was the Book of Mormon, and I would find things that were parallel. So I would talk to them about what the Assyrians believed and you know, poetry.
You're one of those.
Yes. And the State High Council, I had a State High Councilman come because I was filling up the room, and he said he was sent by, he came up after shake my hand, he said he was sent by State President because they just heard that this was a popular class. But it was popular because I'm not because I'm brilliant or anything. It's because I just jumped the guardrails. Mm-hmm. I just started talking from a humanist perspective, and suddenly the religion came alive. Mm. And so that's where I think we can do that. We can become human beings inside this thing again.
Mm. Is that what you're saying? That there is a place for reconciliation? Is that what you're suggesting?
On an individual level.
Right.
The church has committed so many crimes.
Yeah.
And continues to enable the commission of so many crimes of conscience and people they've destroyed, that I don't know the church is redeemable.
Hmm.
If it is, it's not my fight.
Right. At some point it gets beyond the point.
Right.
Hmm.
But so many of our institutions are held up by just obedience. Like if you in any given, I've used this analogy before, but in any given city, I used to be the Bountiful Police Department. We were a 45,000 person city. Peak, we had 5 cops on. 45,000 people, 5 cops. At night, we had 2. Like Like, it would only take 1,000 citizens, if that, maybe 500, maybe 250, to overthrow the police department, right? And government knows this. That's why they're that government systems, church systems, all these work, because we give them power. And I guess my message now would be just, the power is yours. If you want to resign, resign. You know, you were almost excommunicated. Are you officially disfellowshipped now?
No, there was no action. I'm in full fellowship.
Oh, congratulations. I chose to resign.
Yeah.
But my view now is, it's all just a game. Mm-hmm. It means whatever you give it meaning to. And that is really hard to accept. And then if you start putting that to other areas of your life, that's even harder, because you realize you have a lot more moral responsibility as to where you spend your money, as to how many miles you drive, as to how you interact with your neighbors. And that goes to this thing we were talking about. That can be emotionally overwhelming, and we just don't want to deal with it. We don't want to think about it.
Right. So you're kind of entering back into the wound.
In a way. Now, I took four years off from Mormonism.
Mm-hmm.
And I took 2 years off from Facebook.
What does that mean, you took 4 years off from Mormonism?
I didn't follow it.
Right.
I especially didn't follow all the inside baseball, all the the relationships and these organizations coming and these podcasts starting. And we're naturally dividers and splitters. And just pulling back from that gave me time to heal. Do you, on your podcast, I'm sure you get a lot of people who reach out to you.
Mm, yes.
And a lot of those people reach out to you. They're in pain. They're suffering. And you take on some of that pain. You'll get emails you can't shake.
Mm.
They stick with you.
Yes. I think women get less than men do, because, you know, you're in that patriarchal, you know, people are thought to, you know, whether or not you are on the rostrum or you're behind a microphone, the male figure.
Do you get more from men or women?
More women.
You do get more from women?
Yes. Yeah.
Because I Lindsay, my boss, runs in these feminist circles, is they'll sit around swap stories about how men treat, in the post-Mormon world, men treat them bad. Every story they have, I can give them a story where a woman did the same thing to me. And they get mad at me when I say that. But I think it's funny.
Yeah, I can feel the temperature rising as you're saying that.
Well, it is, you know, if I'm at a party and a 125-pound woman comes up and grabs my butt, like, it might be annoying to me, but I don't feel in danger. So I don't want to equate those things. If I'm a 125-pound female who has a 250-pound man come up to her and grab her butt, it's an entirely different thing. And I want to please make sure that everyone understands, I am not equating the experience. Mm-hmm. Because, I fear men too. Men are dangerous. But I don't find myself routinely in situations where men could do me real harm. And every woman finds herself in those situations.
I think so. I think it's there are different kind of economies here. And it points to the larger issue that I think there is a way in which the feminine is always finding ways to outsource herself to the masculine. This is a Mormon issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think, without the proper consciousness, I don't think that changes when people step out of the church.
No.
And so it's like, let's find a new savior. You know, maybe it's going to be John Larson. Maybe it's going to be John DeLynn. You know, there's going to be a new male figure in which there is a significant amount of authority apportioned, because that step away from the church should have been a time to gather oneself back up.
Mm-hmm.
And to really understand the way in which the system has constituted kind of a vacancy and absence of self as you apportion out all of your loyalties and your authority and yourself to these external figures that sit in the institution. And I just think, you know, one of the largest issues of unhealthiness, I think, in the former Mormon community is that hasn't been healed. So we come into the post-Mormon community and add in a bit of sex and harassment and a bit of, kind of celebrity making and, you know, people finding the one, and you get a similar dynamic.
It's all true. And we said this in a podcast a couple of weeks ago. I brought on a panel of people who've been out of church a long time. And I'm guilty as anybody. We talk about the post-Mormon community as if it's a monolith.
Mm.
What happens is, first of all, when you first leave the church, suddenly the guardrails are down. The church is very prescriptive of saying, this is okay, this is not. This is what you do with yourself on a Saturday morning. This is what you do on a Tuesday. This is what you can eat. This is what you can wear. And first of all, that's very disorienting for everybody to go into a pluralistic, liberal world where you can choose to do your own self. That sends people into tailspins, anybody. Because it's just real. It's the biggest parallel I would see is when you see like soldiers who come, you know, rotate back from Afghanistan or something. If you've been around them for the first 2 weeks, they just kind of walk around and blink, like because everything is so restricted and that they're facing danger and all the time. Then they come back and it's like, oh, go do whatever you want, and that passes.
Yes.
Then let's say if you left the church when you're 30, it's, and I don't like the word brainwashed, but we've been programmed, and you, it's deep and it's everywhere, and it takes years to unplug that stuff. So you're right. You said it exactly right. So you mix in alcohol and you mix in, you know, like profit making,
yes.
You know, and then you also mix in the toxic headiness of people who reject that. You know, one of the problems organizations like Sunstone and podcasts have is a lot of people leave the church feel like they were schnookered. They had their money was literally stolen for 30 years, and they add it up and say, "Crap, almighty! I gave $100,000 to the church, or you know, whatever some huge figure is. Whatever it is, it's more than you can afford." And you look back and say, "I gave that much money. I'm not going to do that again." So there's a pullback and a lack of generosity. So you're right. You know, you talk about like the kingmakers, people who might look at somebody like John DeLynn, whether he wants it or not, and they say, okay, they treat him like a prophet. But just as much of the problem is the people surrounding who see that.
Yes.
Sycophantry or how,
yeah,
what is it?
Yeah, yeah.
And they lose their crap over it.
Yes.
Because they're being triggered by this same situation too.
Yeah, and you find people in that cycle. And I think, you know, for women, there is a case of, well, you know, often men find themselves in the situation of being around a woke feminist, and they want a piece of that.
Right.
You know, it's appealing. Suddenly they can have that, you know, there's an attraction to the feminine that looks different from the feminine that they had once before, but similar enough that they can dump their shit on them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a kind of an all-round unhealthiness. And I think that's what pisses me off most about the LDS Church. It doesn't leave people in good shape.
Yes.
To go out into the world and to flourish and to become, particularly not spiritually. And I know, you know, I'm kind of a God girl, and but I think there is a way in which the LDS Church just kind of perverts our own spirituality, a kind of nascent spirituality, all of the questions that causes us to want to, you know, to go deeper into life's questions and to find meaning. And, you know, and it's almost as if when people bug out of the church, and I understand why they do, they're going to bug out of God and Jesus and any conversation that's to do with spirit. And I understand why.
I do too, and it might be a necessary step.
Yes.
If you've been, you know, because people always say all the time, well, why do so many LDS people or former LDS people become atheists? First of all, I say, well, you're probably selecting for your own group. Did you go to the local Baptist church down here? Because it's full of ex-Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
So you're interacting online with people who tend to be smarmy and atheistic and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I do think that these are beliefs, the spirituality was used in a way to control people.
Yes.
And, you know, it's a cliche I bring up all the time. People really lament the loss of prayer oftentimes because they found it cathartic. And I always tell them the same thing. Well, just keep doing it. It works exactly the same.
Or find a different way of doing it.
But for a lot of them, they have to stop. It's part of that healing process.
Yes.
And these things that we're talking about, I'm here to say it does not define the people for the rest of their lives. It defines them for this transitional period till they find their space. Now, if you go to any community, I personally believe about 25% of all males are extremely dangerous. And it's not because, it's because of a lot of things, but let's just boil it down to testosterone. Like, violent males have been an evolutionary advantage for a long time, and we had ways to control them. Well, you kick that man out of the church, and you're going to have predators. I've kind of looked, I don't think the predatory rates are higher. I haven't done a lot of research, so I'm just winging it, are higher in the ex-Mormon community versus just in the normal given secular community in the United States. But it's still there. So people are using the predators, the predatory males, are using those sort of tricks that they used in the church. That I think why the women who are this, and I agree, this is exactly right. You have vulnerable women coming out of the church who've been conditioned to defer to authority, and then you have these males who are just predators, mm-hmm. and they're the minority, and they might be the same predatory rate outside the church. Meaning, I'm saying that Mormonism doesn't necessarily cause sexual predators. But it sure allows for them to function. It's this space where they can do it. And then there's a lot of blame. Some people blame the church. Some people blame the ex-Mormons. But it just is. It's just this weird space we're in.
Yeah, I mean, what I hear you saying then, it just happens naturally. It's naturally occurring within a particular demographic. But the Mormon iteration of it. Well, it's patterned.
I agree. And when I'm looking at culture these days, and I'm looking at it through the lens, because this has been interesting to me, of how we make men behave. Mm. Knowing that the men can be awful. And I'm not going to make any bones saying almost every awful thing that's ever happened to humanity is at the hands of men, right? They're greedy, they're selfish, they're violent, they're overly sexual. Not that all men are that way, but men are that way. And so culture is a way to control that. If you look at the old-fashioned dating rules, like you'd have to call on somebody to meet them in the parlor, a lot of these rules were put in place to protect women from men. We rightfully dismantled those because those rules were also keeping women down. They prevented women from attaining the same kind of success or voice even. Or quality of life that men could. But once we pulled all those rules down, we enabled the worst of the men to behave more badly. And that's what's happening in the ex-Mormon world. It just happens to enable the worst of the men.
Indeed. And I think you're right to say that there's a way in which having that rule-based system, even though it was patriarchal, pulled in the worst excesses. And once released from the control of that institutional authority, it can just sort of trigger, you know, kind of an abandon,
right,
when it comes to the way that women are treated. Yeah.
So we don't know how to organize ex-Mormon communities. They organize on themselves.
Yeah.
They tend to be short-lived, and then they just evolve into natural, like, friendship sort of groups, or the, you know, negative word would be clique, but I mean, that's what we do. You can't maintain 700 friends. Mm. And so I think in general it's a positive stage growth, but when we focus on that space, which of course, as you're kind of asking me, why are you coming back into this space? Because you recognize this space is sort of toxic.
Yes. Yeah. So, like, I mean, I think a lot of people want to make you, John Larson, accountable for the last place that you were in. So what words do you have to fill in that space between the last place that you were in when you were in the public eye?
Well, I was just reading Marshall Brooks's book. He he's a friend of mine. We're going to have him on the podcast. Well, he just released a book. And I need to look up the title here. I'll look it up in a second. But he was an anthropologist who was embedded in Utah for 2 years. And he studied the ex-Mormon community. He just released the book. I'm partway through it. I'll tell you that my name is Paul sometimes in the book, but I haven't determined all the times my name is. But I was reading, he put the transcript of the speech that I gave when we did the mass resignation in 2012. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's the same stuff I'm saying now. Mm-hmm. You know, pluralism, we've got to learn to get along. The church needs to learn to recognize the ex-Mormons and not just try to excommunicate them and go away. So I don't see a huge philosophical difference. What I'll tell you is I've recognized that a lot of this stuff has made me angry, that I've had to deal with anger. And I think sometimes it's righteous indignation. You know, when I see people getting really hurt by the church, it amps me up. And I know that some of my fan base, that was when John Larson got amped up and got on a roll, that was their favorite part. And so I have to work now to not get angry about the Trump administration, not get angry about corporate excess, not get angry about the church. The reason is I don't like what anger does to me. It's poisonous. And that's my message is and I say this to people, you're justified in your feelings. You're justified at being mad at the church. Your mom treated you poorly. You're justified at yelling at her and being mad at her and separating her from your kids because she's saying things to them she shouldn't be saying. But the anger is poison.
I love that you raised that. Because I think, you and I are both podcasters and, I'm a writer and I can get my ire up. I can get my dander up really well. Mm-hmm. And I think like you, it's wearisome after a while. You think, okay, what is the end of this? But you can cash up on anger. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if the more angry you get, the more that people can project onto you their own anger. And it's like you're resolving it, but you're not resolving it. And, I look at exit stories and I look at the kind of podcasts that generate a sort of fervor of fury. And I can post stuff and say, I'm really pissed off about this. And, suddenly there's 600 likes. And but I think, it's harder to walk into this space and generate a third conversation because it asks people to relinquish something. And we think, I think that we are in this pathology of saying, if I can accumulate, if I can have more feeling, if I can have more anger, if I can have more outrage and more stuff to be furious about, then I'm acquiring something. But I think what maybe you and I both in that space where we're seeing the need to just let stuff go in a healthy way, to farewell things. And it's a risky space, isn't it? Because people are just a little uncomfortable with the way in which now you've unseated them.
It's a vulnerable space. It's something I've learned. I have tried to coach female friends, employees for me, people I work with, hell, Lindsay, all the time. To for example, to what I try to do in the work environment is to teach men to be less male-like and teach women to be more male-like, i.e., I try to coach women on how to interrupt more. Mm. I try to coach women on how to apologize less. But the route I'm trying to take is to do a swap. So I find myself apologizing more and acknowledging when I make mistakes. And it is so disarming to people. We have a culture where nobody ever apologizes for anything. And when you do, and I'm talking sincerely apologize, you can't just fake that. Mm. You have to be sincere about it. It disarms people, and they don't exactly know what to do with you at that point. Because if they say, John Larson, in 2011, you said this terrible thing, and I'd say, yeah, here's probably what I was doing, I could change the delivery on that. That they don't really know where to go. But you were saying something I think very important. Somebody who podcasts for a while, like you have rights for a while, you learn how to game the system. Yep. Meaning you know which podcasts are going to get a lot of attention, which ones aren't. I think one of the struggles that people are having now, this will be episode 15 or 16, is they don't know where to put it. Because I was talking to my wife, Kimmy, last night. We were talking about this, and she told me to stop talking about it because it was stressing her out. There's this element of performance when you're in something like this. And there's this ideal point that you can push it to. If you go across it, it will be unhealthy for you, but it might get more response. It's what Facebook's AI algorithms discovered with nobody pointing to, that what we consume more than anything else is outrage. And it's like we've all been binging on it, like we're all junkies on H. And what we're junkies for is outrage. And we're just used to that adrenaline hit that you get from it all the time. And as anybody who's ever been in a highly adrenaline situation, like a car accident, you'll know you'll be shaking after you come down from all that adrenaline. And I think that almost describes our culture. Like we're so, you read the newspaper, you go onto Facebook, it's just outrage, 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 outrage. And that has fueled both the Mormon and the ex-Mormon community. And what I'm saying is, let's step back from that for a minute. And people just don't know what to do with that message.
Yeah, you're asking a lot. I mean, we're asking a lot. I mean, I put my outrage into questions of sexual abuse in the church, because I think that's a really present mm-hmm. issue, and we need to be literate and understand the depth of this issue. I think that's really important. But I think, you know, I look at, but, you know, on the other hand, I do things on spiritual formation and spiritual growth and faith and how to grow that outside of the institution and what to expect. If you pay attention to, and you know, some people will, some people won't, I don't really care. But if that is your thing, if you're paying attention to your spiritual growth, know that other people have thought about this. You can outsource some of these conversations and models for spiritual growth outside of the Mormon community.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, there's kind of a, I think there's a healthiness maintaining the balance, but the outrage, I think, comes when, and I look at your president and I don't have any idea how any human being in their right mind can vote for that man. And I try and ignore him, but I, you know, where I'm staying with Kim and Terry Turner, you know, sometimes, you know, CNN's on in the morning and I look at him and I think, I have no words for that person, and I can feel myself boiling and beginning to boil. But I think one of the curatives for dealing with the kind of outrage that you might get at an individual figure is to understand that system that that person is constituted in. That takes the bitterness away, and it takes a sense of disempowerment away. There's a real power that can be gained from understanding systems and being able to literally deconstruct institutions and understand why they are the way they are in the context in which they are. So, you know, a lot of people say, well, I don't like this person, and or I don't like that person. Well, what can you do with that?
Hmm.
I mean, you know, Mormonism has a great way of kind of plucking out the latest sort of anti-hero and the person to dump on. I mean, you know, I don't particularly have any affection for Russell Nelson, but he's an easy target, right? You know, I mean, I found myself doing this. I get really pissed off with him and his silly wife, Wendy. That was really mean to say. I'm sure she's not silly. But, you know, there is kind of a punctuation mark there. That means that there's no resolution. I can sit in my fury, my irritation with a human being, or I can step back and say, okay, tell me about this. Let's have a look at this larger system. And then once you are able to deconstruct this, understand the system, you can deconstruct the system, and then you can imaginatively and hopefully reconstruct that system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the issue that I have with the way Mormons, former Mormons, are kind of addicted to the outrage.
Well, and they're addicted to the church.
Some, I should say.
Like,
yeah.
Ex-Mormons, especially the freshies, the people who've been out less than, say, 2 years, they watch conference at a mm-hmm. higher rate than anybody in the world.
Yeah.
And because that outrage gives you that adrenaline shot. It's that dopamine and sort of thing that drives social media behavior. You post something, and we've all done this, and none of us will admit, post something, and then you refresh, and then you refresh, and you refresh. You get to the end of the day, and if you were to count it, you say, I checked that thing 122 times, because getting those likes can give you a dopamine hit,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I think the ex-Mormons, when they're watching conference and they're seeing these things that they think are screwed up, it's confirmational bias, and that is like a drug, and they just hit it.
Yeah.
And
but don't you think it's the same family as the confirmation bias that you get when you're in the church?
I think for some people, like that never played out for me, but I recognize it now because the way. Spiritual responses, and I want to get back because you keep hinting at that you're spiritual and you have theism. I consider myself
spiritual.
I've sort of grown into that more. But for some people, the Mormon church can be a very spiritual experience. It wasn't for me. And what I can't do is ridicule the reality of that experience, that communal connectedness that they would feel because it didn't work for me. And I've done that. You know, and it was easier for me to ridicule that because it didn't speak to me if you ever watched that movie, a movie that you just love, you love the character, you know, it's silly, you know, it's full of problems, but it was pleasant for you to watch. And then somebody is making fun of it and you know, they're right. But you're like, I didn't watch that movie because it was a historical interaction about the 18th century. I watched it because I fell in love with these two characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes folks like me can be just, we're just stomping through the flowers, you know? Mm. And so much of our behavior, this is something else we never want to admit, is self-justification. We make decisions and then we do everything in the world to make sure the world sees that we made the right decision.
You look pretty righteous, so I'm not sure you're going to understand this simile. But most podcasts are like beer. You have to drink a lot to get that buzz. The Sunstone Magazine podcast, on the other hand, is like whiskey. Small glass, big buzz. That's because our podcast isn't about interviews, conversation, or witty banter. Rather, it presents audible quality recordings of Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry. Do you want to hear what the best LDS minds have to say when they say it perfectly? Then this podcast is for you. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone, and then join us for a weekly shot of the best of Mormon thought and experience. And yes, you'll be able to drive home safely afterward and get a temple recommend if you want.
So let's talk about your spirituality. So you in all of your slide, you never lost your faith in God.
I think there was a point where I think at the apex of all faith traditions, we became atheistic, because the universal experience is one in which we're drawn into, I suppose, the God self within. And so God ceases to be something that's just sort of randomly transcendent or, you know, out there, but something kind of closer in. There's an interiority of the self that is so drenched in meaning and kind of and depth and wonder and possibility.
Of course I've had to, and I think maybe part of me is atheistic. More of an atheistic agnostic. Mm-hmm. I think I have to acknowledge that part of me. I'm at the point where I don't really need to know that there is a God, but I still, the idea of God is still a really potent symbol for me in which to kind of collapse my kind of, interest in the spiritual.
Well, and I wonder, as I'm listening to you talk, how much, you know, sort of a Maori tradition would have entered into your consciousness, which wouldn't take the same kind of patriarch. I mean, the God of the patriarchs is a patriarchal God, right? There's a quote by a feminist writer. I can't remember her name. I posted it a little while ago, and I think most people didn't understand it, which is if God is male, then male is God. Basically saying once you give that attribute to God, then the masculine is by default superior.
Yes.
And I you said something interesting that I want to jump on. It's sort of like these religions that are around today, like Mormonism, Catholicism, especially these Western religions, they are very atheistic. If we go back in time 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, you know, my village would have had this tree that we take care of, and it produces figs, and then we started talking about the God that lives in the tree, and then that kind of extended out, and then my village met your village, you have another God that lives in the pond, and we're like, oh cool, you guys have, you know, there's the pond God, and we have the tree God, and for a lot of human history, God was an amorphous thing. You know, if you take the Greeks or the Romans or the Chinese or whatever, they would have their pantheon of gods because God didn't take any particular shape. But once we started becoming monotheistic, and very specifically monotheistic, once we started recreating our ideal id in the form of God, then we became very dismissive of every other god. And Mormonism is a religion, like many others, have backed themselves into a corner because they've defined God so narrowly and so ridiculously that God can't exist. It's just an impossibility. And then once you get that, Mormonism is an atheistic religion except for this one Elohim dude. And once you reject Elohim, you're left with nothing. And so I think it takes people time to, they either jump to another Elohim over here,
right,
or it takes time for them to reconstruct this concept of God in a way that they can touch.
I think so, yeah. But I think one of the other pathologies, I think, in Mormonism is that God that we talk about is so impossible. And I think that people understand the impossibility at one level of the God that they're trying to imagine, and the disappointment of that God. And so they outsource God to the brethren and to the president of the church. And I think there's a, and I'm thinking about, you know, a quote that we use in theology school, you know, God constructed, created us in our image, and we've been creating God in our image ever since. And I think in Mormonism, that's been seen quite starkly. That, in fact, you don't need to have God at all. You don't really need to have Jesus. And I got to this point in my conversations with my priesthood leaders, and I said, I can't tell you that Jesus Christ is a Christ. I am compelled by Jesus' ministry. There is something so beautifully subversive for this Maori girl in his ministry and his movement and the way in which he turned everything upside down. All logical awareness of the culture of that time, he turned upside down and challenged. There's something that really appeals to me as a colonial subject in that. And there's something godlike in the way that he approached
it. Well, and he was a colonial subject.
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
And it's interesting you bring that up because I noticed something a few months ago. I find myself quoting the New Testament all the time in my own head. And in my journey with the New Testament is kind of interesting because at 17, I read the New Testament. And it's not like I was super conservative before. My family, they grew up very, very centrist. So like the radical right-wing stuff that's so prevalent in Mormonism, luckily I didn't get a lot of that. But it sent me right to the left. You know, when I read Jesus, I'm like, we should be taking care of the poor. Like, we should spend less time worrying about business and things. So the New Testament in particular shaped my ethics that have remained today.
Yes.
Then I became very hardcore. I read all the, you know, the Four Horsemen, you know, Daniel Dennett and all those guys, Harris and blah blah blah, and those things spoke to me, and they really helped me deconstruct things. But then they became just vacuous to me. It's like, you're right. I read those books and I say, you know, people said, you read Sam Harris' last book? I'm like, no, because I know what he's going to say. And for me, there's a couple of inflection points. And I hope we don't get too deep here, but time, Einstein showed us, and physicists have shown us since then, is interchangeable with energy, or it's on the same spectrum, and time itself was part of the Big Bang, right? It created time. That is this opening to meaning and evolution, the spark of life, that at one moment there wasn't life, and the next moment there was life that was able to reproduce and started and produced the variety that we have here. These things do not lead me into a traditional theology. It more like leads me into a neo-animism that, like, every bit of life on this planet is miraculous. You think about it. I mean, the universe has been around for 12 billion years. It'll be around for another 20, 25 billion. We don't know. And we're at this slice in time. And you and I both sprung into consciousness. How? Who the hell knows? What does it even mean? We don't even understand that. But here we are, we're in the same room having this conversation. The divinity of this moment, the divinity of the mundane speaks volumes to me. And I guess if you want to take it back, it's like we are all alive and we're all experiencing the same pain. We live in the same bodies. And that is so beautiful. It's like, what are we fighting about? We're fighting about things we don't even understand. We don't even understand. And it's the thing I say about atheism. I can't be an atheist because I don't know what it means to be a theist.
Right. Yes.
And what I see is most people define themselves as atheists. They are actually a subset of whatever religion. If you talk to an atheist for 5 minutes, you can figure out what religion she is. Because she's going to reverse something. She's a Catholic atheist or a Mormon atheist, but it's still a part of the theological, like Mormon atheists are still part of the theological shield of Mormonism. They have to go further before they can break that down.
But I think, you know, when you talk up all these isms and identities, I think people are just so looking for the thing, as I said before, the thing to think, but also they're looking for identity, right? You know, and I'm in the fortunate position that I'm a Maori woman. I have particular tribes. And I remember when I was a young woman, there being this massive argument in Relief Society between a very strong Maori woman an American woman who was living in our ward, who actually ended up being my adopted mother. But anyway, and Darlene said to Marianne, Darlene's the Māori woman, she said, "I am Māori first. I am Māori first. And then I'll decide where my Mormonism is." And she's been a faithful Mormon woman. So I always had that identity to fall back on because nobody can take that away from me. And that's not, it's not up for grabs. It just is. And so that defines, so I don't need to find my identity. I don't need it. And I can see that religion, because it's been so fought over, like, you know, one's national identity has been fought over, that there's kind of an athletic, kind of aggressive, muscular attempt to appropriate an identity to make sense of the self. So I understand the kind of strange privilege I have as an Indigenous woman to be able to say, look, I'm Ngāti Porou. That means that my river is Waiapu and my mountain is Hikurangi, and that's where the story ends for me. So if you're in that position of wanting to know what defines you, it can get really scrappy because if somebody else is in control of that identity, there's nothing else. You know, you kind of be moved around like wind, you know, like leaves in the wind. And I feel that deep sense of people wanting something, a ground of being, something to kind of settle them, something that can make their world makes sense, a hermeneutic, if you will, a worldview in which they can kind of filter things through, that create a sense of solidity and security in the self. And I think that's what we've got a lot of vulnerable people, particularly in the former Mormon community, who now can't trust a moral system or can't or find it very difficult, understandably, to find it difficult to understand a system of principles. And I don't really care where it comes from, whether it comes from theism or atheism or agnosticism. There's something really solid about knowing where your feet stand. And this is why I love the idea of spirituality, because there is a way of being in, it sounds so kind of crass. There's a way of being, and, you know, Paul Tillich talks about the ground of being, that there is something really firm underneath. But it kind of takes silence to get there, a self-emptying. And we're not talking about God having a penis and God being a man. We're talking about just the soul ability to still and to find where the feet are. And then once you've found where the feet are, and you don't know, it could be different for everybody, but there's kind of a security in that silence. Mormonism is so filled with words, 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 all the time, words and ideas. And sometimes it's very difficult to shut up. And I expect that 4 years is like, okay, I just need to stop thinking about, it's just chaotic.
I like that. And the words are oftentimes traps because they're amorphous.
Yeah.
And they're tautological.
Yes.
You know, faith is the hope of charity. You know, I just threw three words that don't even have definitions at you. And you're like, oh, all right. You know, it's like the Deepak Chopra, like, saying generator. Mm-hmm. So much of when I listen to conference now, I just say, they're not saying anything.
Or do you listen to it?
I haven't for years.
All right.
I did, but for the same reason I don't listen to, like, the Scientology conference. It doesn't speak to me.
Right.
It doesn't fulfill me at all, you know. I think about, you know, if you think about, like, a 10-inch wide board, any of us could walk that and not slip off of it. Because, you know, if you do, you're gonna hit the ground. Mm. Let's say it's sitting 6 inches above the ground. Now imagine that same board, and it's 1,000. You're crossing a canyon 1,000 feet. That's sometimes what leaving a religion, like a very structured religion like Mormonism, because it's telling you how to think. It's the ground. It's giving you safe spaces.
Yes.
And you go out there and you realize that the ground is an illusion. The board is real. It is really scary and it's really disorienting. And that's why sometimes the pleasures of life, the pleasures of the flesh or whatever, not there's anything bad about those per se, but that they can be a new guardrail that people slip to. And I think what you're talking about and what I'm experiencing as I age is an embracing of the ambiguity.
Mm. Grace and wisdom require you to sit in silence with the ambiguity, the paradox, and the uncertainty. And there's something phenomenal about that. You're not taught, I think, most in our Western systems. You're taught to know what to think. And You're taught a set of ideas. But in this way of being, there is a wonderful, a surprising solidness to accepting the opposites. So, I mean, I posted on my Facebook page a picture of a young woman, a police officer in New Zealand, holding a semi-automatic rifle, where she's a white woman, blonde woman, with a hijab, with a rose, and like on her lapel, on her flak jacket. And there was all of these kind of contradictions that it's so disruptive in that moment of visual space. And you can't make one story up out of that. You certainly can't make a story up out of context. And just relaxing with that, that there is no single story, was actually very kind of, it was a relief. It was, you're able to get rid of some of the neediness that you have. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like, there's just sort of like, ah, the church is vile. The church is beautiful. Okay, let's just sit with that for a moment. Just sit with it.
And I think by extension, we so much, especially those who become very scientifically minded, which I am by nature, but the recognition that you can't get rid of all of the paradox. As a matter of fact, I spent a few years studying the philosophy of science, which if you don't want your head baked, stay away from it. Because ex-Mormons will say, oh, you know, I had to leave the church to get rid of cognitive dissonance. And a scientific philosopher will tell you there is no scientific theory that we have today that doesn't have dissonance. Meaning, if you say a theory is only sound if it has no contradiction, you have to throw out all of human understanding because all the systems have contradiction in them. And it goes back to what we were talking about a half hour ago. It's just, we can sit with it because we don't know the problems, you know, and there's that ignorance of not wanting to know if there's 11-year-old stitching my shoes together and not wanting to know that there's bishops who put children into sexually abusive situations just by asking them questions. And once you recognize saying, no matter where I turn in this world, I'm going to find that. So this goes to that question about me, and we've talked about me way too much. You're a ninja, I guess. is recognizing that I don't have power over big systems. I don't have any power over the church, but I do have power over the relationship I have with my neighbor or with my brother. Mm. And what I've basically done is rejected all the big systems, all of them.
Yes.
And I was finally able to resolve my problem with Trump and all that is to realize I had no control over any of that. So why was I worrying about it at all? That was all completely wasted.
Right, right. And I love what you say about like stopping your anxiety about the big things. I think, you know, I think we should be rightly concerned about systems. But on a day-to-day, in terms of our own practice, there's just being in the small things that, and the mundane and the ordinary, that's really sacred. Mm. You know, I'm thinking about, okay, so I have in this progressive, this strange little progressive Mormon world, I have a reasonably large voice. But I ached for community with people who are face-to-face.
Yes.
And that's what took me into an Anglican community. I needed to feel safe. I needed to have people that I could share the rail with and I could sing with. And I needed those small interactions. And I needed not to be the Mormon big mouth. You know, there was something really healing about letting go of the need for, I suppose, attention or for the voice or for the, you know, the podium. And that was so healing. It's in that, the smallness and the sacredness and the jewels of the mundane, I think, that we really find ourselves. I think we're always looking for, Mormons are like, have got these huge audacious ideas. You know, we both grew up with it. You know, we're the only this and we're the only that. And, you know, we're going to get to heaven. And they use the language of empire, kings, and you're going to be anointed kings and queens and priests and priestesses and called up and anointed and receive a kingdom and, you know, a set of steak knives and wives, you know. I mean, the whole thing is audacious.
We literally build the buildings to mimic the best of Greek architecture or the 19th century Mormons trying to take and build out like the mansions they saw in the East Coast. It is literally trying to take wealth and box heaven into this space.
Yes. Yeah.
Like temples always were beautiful to me, but to me now they're like beautiful the way a Marriott is beautiful. I guess they're well designed, but it's I can find more spirituality just in the mundane interactions of people, of going to, let's say, I don't know, a Peruvian restaurant that only Peruvians go to, you know, only people from Peru go to. When I find those places, it's much more spiritual to me than the celestial kingdom.
Indeed. And it's that, you know, we're always concentrating on numbers, right? You know, like, how big is it? How big is it? And so I can kind of get behind it. Like, how many likes do I have on Facebook? Or how many people read my blog? Or how many downloads of my podcast have? And I've got to the point where I'm saying it doesn't really matter. Everybody who needs to hear that, I hope will hear it. And right. even if it's three people, that's absolutely fine. And that's that. I think that's the surrender of ego. Like, I think there's a way in which our Mormon lives kind of build up our ego and attach a lot of things to that sense of identity. You're going to get this, and you're going to get this, and do this, and you're going to be seen as this. But I suppose that's the reflex. You know, as we kind of come to the end of this, the reflex and that I hope that we can be part of the conversation and is building, is letting things go in a gracious, wise way, and paying attention to the self and the sacredness of companionship and friendship and neighborhood and acts of radical hospitality. I mean, I now meet in a $6 million building that we constructed in the Anglican Church, and I kind of miss, because we had an earthquake and the church fell down, and so we were meeting in like an auditorium of a private girls' school, which is just kind of yucky and vacuous and cavernous. It was horrible. But I kind of miss it. I miss that we didn't have to, it was just a few of us there, and we didn't have to think about who's going to clean the building, or, you know, about repairs, or who's on the hospitality committee and things like that. It was just something really intimate.
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's as you start looking around and say, what is a meaningful life look like? And I don't know what happens to us after we die. I'm pretty certain our thoughts are an excretion of our brains, and our brains rot. So, you know, I give the probability of surviving my death about the same probability that I'm secretly a billionaire and I just don't know about it.
But it doesn't matter after a while.
It doesn't matter. I think there's a certain sacredness to life when it's just the here and now.
Yes.
I was, again, talking to my wife last night, and I said, you know, like, people don't like the idea that they only have one life. I don't think it's as much that it's going to end, although no one wants to face the end of it. It's that this is the only opportunity I get. But let's say you died tomorrow and then woke up the next day. You're still only living one life. It just got extended.
Yes.
And there's going to be another set of circumstances if that happens. But you're still going to be you. If you're not going to be you, then it's the same as dying, right?
Right, yeah.
So we're trying to reduce tension by telling these stories. Oh, we die and then we'll go to heaven and everything will be great. But even if that's true, it's not true. There's no way it could be. There's no way it can be true, because we still have to interact from our blinder position in this universe with the rest of the universe. And I think as we age and mellow, maybe we recognize the beauty of all that. And I kind of want to hit everybody that I've been around, communities that I've amped up myself, and said, wait a minute, just take a minute, feel that breeze, look at the grass here. Let's just take the afternoon off, have a picnic. All of you come,
right,
you know.
Yeah,
and that's where I am.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we have to acknowledge that, you know, when we say ex-Mormons, I think we're saying that about aspects of ourselves as much as anybody else.
Right.
But also what we notice, because we're in this position where we're observant about the general kind of patterns and moods of the community that we love.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in love with my Mormon community. Oh my goodness. Like, these are the coolest people.
I am fascinated. And again, I know this is sort of an age thing, that I look at my ancestors, you know, the people who came and settled this valley, and the people who worked hard, and they were salty people. And if my mom's to be believed, a lot of them were assholes.
Yeah.
She won't.
It's kind of European immigrants.
Yeah. It's that you know, Scandinavian, really standoffish, judgy, but still sort of a libertarian. Well, you go live the way you want, but we're going to frown at you for it.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of that stuff. But why would I want to divorce myself from that? I want to understand it. I'm a part of it, and there's this misconception that you can leave your Mormon identity. Even if you were a convert and only part of the church for 2 years, that's 2 years of your life. And it's not healthy to try to erase it. You know, the people who break up with somebody they're dating, then delete all the pictures and burn all the letters, that is not a healthy way to live. Better is to put it all in a trunk, put it down in the basement, and only go open that trunk when you're ready. And that's I think what people need to do. And I hope I'm not sounding critical to everything people do. And I know there's a lot of criticism for ex-Mormons and their sexual exploration. And I'm like the lone like public voice out there defending it, saying, you know, people have to work through stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, it's all their journey. And no matter what we do in life, it can be earning money. There's people who take it too far and it destroys their life. There's people who it's fine with. So if we can somehow honor all of the journeys, but I'm not naive, our journeys collide. And there's real pain and suffering that's out there.
Indeed. But I mean, I think it's right across all the communities, whether people are in or out of the church. And I think when it comes down to it, you know, I come from a city that's just been terrorized.
Right.
And our reflex is just to sit quietly. Everybody wants to solve the problem, right? You know, like everybody's got an opinion about what should happen. But I think we're in that place of let's just sit.
It is, and there's no perfect answer. No. I've been so impressed with the response by New Zealand Until today, which I don't know if you follow this, but the manifesto that he written, I think they're going through legislation that even having a copy of it on your computer will be a crime.
Yeah.
And that's just there's something about it where the government can start saying documents you're not allowed to read, you're not allowed to have.
Yeah, it's unprecedented. It's not usually that. It's the chief censor could make a thing. And I know that's sort of pressing all your kind of free speech buttons.
It is. And
as a New Zealander, I'm like, I'm okay with that. I really am.
But yeah. I've been, the world has been pressing all my free speech buttons for like 3 years. Right. I am so tired of the ambivalence on that because I see, you know, I was joking around. If you were to turn off your spam filters, what's your ratio of people trying to defraud you, take advantage of you, scam you to real emails you get? It's probably at least 1,000 to 1.
I'm not sure. Yeah,
it's a lot. Yeah, you know, you get just a lot of people trying to manipulate you. Phone calls. I don't answer my phone. If I don't recognize your number, you should leave a message. I'll probably call you back immediately because most of the calls I get that way are fraudulent. They're people trying to take advantage of me, right? The texts are fraud. You know, like we're surrounded by people all the time trying to take advantage of us. And it gets tiresome. Mm. And so we have these principles of having an open culture and let live and let live. I'm very libertine. I'm very much live and let live. You do what you're going to do. But I recognize that there's these forces around me that are taking advantage of that. And I'm flummoxed. I don't know exactly where to go.
Well, that's giving up an idea. And I feel the same way as you. But then I think that for all human beings to flourish, some decisions, hard decisions, need to be made. And I'm happy with that decision, actually. I'm happy with that decision. They took down a picture of the video feed, and I'm going to have to admit, I looked at it.
I did it inadvertently. I was
painful. I wish I didn't.
I have been trying to, again, I hinted at that the issues of male dominance, male violence, and feminism are very important to me. And one of the things that I'm trying to puzzle out, I think that oftentimes the way that the message of what feminists and people are saying to men are right, but the message is delivered in such a way that men don't listen. And that's a problem that I think is very important to me. So I have been in some of these incel. I was in there and I inadvertently clicked on a link and somebody had uploaded that video.
All right,
and
yes.
And for a minute I didn't know what I was looking at. And then I did, and I'm like, why is this here?
Yeah.
You know, like, but to me, I look at almost every perpetrator. When I hear Donald Trump talk, I hear pain.
Yeah.
I hear somebody who does not know how to form loving relationships. Somebody who has no support. And I think if we're going to, you know, wrap this all up, the fact that we need love and we need community and we need to learn to live together is way more important than being right about any of this stuff.
Indeed. Well said, John Larson. I think that's the whole point of what we're saying, isn't it?
So did I demystify who John Larson is?
I think he did. Yeah. And it's all part of the journey, isn't it? It's all part of the journey.
It's all part of the journey. And I have no qualms still saying I don't like the corporate church. But I think I can sit with ambiguity. Well, it's been fantastic to talk to you and to be here in person and to finally meet you. Any last words for everybody out there?
No, I just like, thanks, John, and you know, I wish you all the best in this new venture of yours.
Well, for sure, next time you're in town, let me know. We'll have you over for dinner.
Excellent.
And then, but more importantly, I need to head down to New Zealand.
You do. Yeah, everyone should come, but you never do. You Americans.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, John.